Welcome to the 26th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to New York City for a State of the Science Summit on multiple myeloma. At the meeting, we spoke with the faculty of Mount Sinai to get their take on stem cell transplant, minimal residual disease, maintenance options, and treatment approaches for newly diagnosed myeloma. They also discussed outcomes for relapse refractory disease, novel agents in development, chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy, and immunotherapy. To kick off the meeting, we spoke with Sundar Jagannath, MD, who is the director of the Multiple Myeloma Program and professor of medicine at the Tisch Cancer Institute within Mount Sinai Health System. Jagannath dove into therapeutic approaches for patients with newly diagnosed multiple myeloma, prefacing with the importance of understanding the biology of the disease to successfully inform treatment approaches for patients.
There are two founder clones in myeloma. One is hyperdiploid and another one is non-hyperdiploid. And these founder clones start out as an MGUS and they continue to multiply over the years. And during that time, they undergo additional mutations, which gives them growth advantage. And finally, it goes through smoldering myeloma phase and then multiple myeloma phase. So by the time a patient is diagnosed with multiple myeloma, he has one of these founder clones which has expanded in his body, spread over the place, and has acquired many mutations. So each patient has at least 4 to 6 different clones in the body. Why is this important to understand? When you're trying to treat the patient with drugs, you know one drug is not going to cure the patient or two drug is not going to cure the patient. So you need combination therapy right from the outset because of the biology of the disease that each patient has 4 to 6 different clones. So that is important to understand. When we all look at any cancer, we think that if you give a particular chemotherapy, they may develop resistance to the chemotherapy after they are exposed to the drug. The biology says the otherwise. There are actually mutations have happened even before, and the drug-resistant clone is already resident in the patient right from the outset. So when you give these combination chemotherapy, what happens is you get rid of most of the drug-sensitive clone, and then you are left with this small clone of drug-resistant clone, which eventually grows back and comes back as a relapse. So myeloma is a highly treatable cancer, but not necessarily curable. It doesn't mean that we don't cure any myeloma patient. We do cure about 10 to 15% of the myeloma patients, but in vast majority, the disease tends to come back. And therefore, understanding the biology that it starts as a clone which multiplies over the period of years and develops additional mutations, and that is important to understand. So once we have gone through that, the next important thing to understand is that, you know, any cancer, it is your own body cell which has had a mutation, genetic change, and then it became a cancer. That means you have your own body cell which has become a cancer. So I look at the cancer like a terrorist which is residing in the community surrounded by the healthy cells. So actually, just like in real life, we can get rid of the terrorists if the community doesn't want the terrorists to hide among themselves. Likewise, the surrounding cells can actually get rid of the cancer cells. So we want to understand why the cancer cell was able to proliferate, fool the surrounding normal cells, and now how can we stimulate the immune cells there to recognize the cancer cells and eliminate them. Now, before we were only using chemotherapy drugs and looking at the genetics and saying resistant, non-resistant. Now, immuno-oncology has come to play a big role in myeloma. And in immuno-oncology, what you essentially do is take the surrounding healthy immune cells and turn them against the cancer so the myeloma could be eradicated. And this is quite successful even if the cancer cell has genetic mutation, which would show that it has resistance to many of the chemotherapy drugs we currently have.
Deepu Maduri, MD, assistant professor at Mount Sinai Hospital, followed suit and took to the stage to discuss the status of transplant, minimal residual disease, maintenance, and CAR T-cell products in the treatment schema. Though several CAR T products are under development, including BB2121 and the next generation product BB21217, have shown great promise, Maduri explained that transplant is still the recommended approach for eligible patients.
So to be eligible for transplant, I think under 75 is generally who we look at for transplant. You have to be fit, you have to be healthy. I mean, we try to distinguish between the frail patients versus elderly frail patients who are transplant ineligible versus the patients who are eligible. You could have comorbidities such as you could be on dialysis, but you would just get a dose-reduced transplant. There are a lot of new trials that are talking about doublets versus triplets, and we all know from the SWOG study triplets are better than doublets. And then now with quadruplets, the Maya study is pending, and there's some other studies comparing carfilzomib upfront with daratumumab and what that's going to do. So far with the induction, current induction treatments, it's still shown by the IFM study the transplant is still better than no transplant. The other important question will be consolidation and maintenance, which I touch on a little bit, and MRD negativity, since we are moving towards an MRD negative world, and all patients we're trying to look at and see if they're MRD negative or not. The consolidation portion is whether or not doing consolidation for patients after transplant is important or not. Some of the studies so far have shown that they have shown a PFS survival benefit, but not as much OS. And in terms of maintenance, we all know we use len maintenance post-transplant. There are studies with bortezomib, which has shown that in high-risk patients and renal insufficiency, maybe bortezomib maintenance is also a good idea.
Though physicians have made great strides in treatment, Hearn J. Cho, MD, PhD, explained that there remains a knowledge deficit in the paradigm, especially with regard to immunotherapy. In 2017, the FDA halted trials with checkpoint inhibitors in myeloma, which resulted from a lack of understanding of the basic mechanisms of these agents, explained Cho. Since then, the FDA hold has been lifted and investigators have begun to pursue combinations with checkpoint inhibitors, antibody drug conjugates, and bispecific T-cell engagers. Listen below to hear from Cho, who serves as an associate professor of medicine and hematology oncology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital, on how the field can deliver rational and clinically meaningful combinations to patients.
So in the pembrolizumab studies, at an interim analysis, it was noted that there were higher numbers of deaths in the experimental arm combining pembrolizumab with pomalidomide or lenalidomide and dexamethasone compared to the control arms, either pomdex or lendex. The concern was that these deaths were due largely to immune-related adverse events, which is a known risk in checkpoint inhibitor therapy. The other concern was that in the interim data, which was not fully accrued, there did not appear to be a survival difference between the patients getting the experimental arm and the patients getting the control arm. Now, these trials were only about 50% to two-thirds accrued at the time that these interim analyses were done. So, in follow-up review of the data, it was noted that there was actually some potential for imbalance in the patient arms. So in terms of patient age or comorbidities or numbers of prior therapies, because they did not fully accrue, there was some imbalance in those arms that may have contributed to these differences. Nevertheless, I think it was prudent for the FDA to halt these trials for review. I don't necessarily agree with the decision by the sponsors to terminate these trials, because I think it's premature. It's fairly clear from the early phase data, so from the phase one trials and the phase two trials, there was activity of these agents in multiple myeloma. And it's pretty clear that immune therapies are effective in multiple myeloma, and we should have as many tools available to us as possible that can be safely applied in the myeloma population. So ongoing studies are actually doing combination immunotherapy. So we're combining things like daratumumab with immune checkpoint inhibitors. Current clinical trials include nivolumab and atezolizumab, which are both FDA approved for solid tumor indications. And I think it's important that we continue this line of work under appropriate safety review in order to find what the role for these powerful immune therapy agents will be in multiple myeloma. So there's two FDA-approved monoclonal antibodies for myeloma, one targeting CD38, that's daratumumab, the other targeting SLAMF7, which is elotuzumab. And both of these agents, particularly in combinations, have excellent response data and long-term follow-up data. There are a number of antibody-based therapies targeting BCMA, similar to the CAR T-cell therapies. Some of these have shown excellent activity. The BCMA antibody drug conjugates and the BCMA bispecific agents both have shown very promising response data, especially in the early phase clinical trials. There are a number of other targets that are under investigation. Different strategies targeting CD38, for example, strategies targeting CD138, which is a common immunophenotypic marker of multiple myeloma. It's not clear whether there's a quote-unquote best target out there right now. It's pretty apparent there's a lot of interest in BCMA, so we'll see how those pan out.
Transitioning to relapse refractory disease was Ajay Chari, MD, Associate Professor of Medicine, Hematology and Medical Oncology at Mount Sinai Hospital, and chair of the meeting. When we sat down with Chari, he acknowledged the difficulty of sorting through the immense number of potential combinations that are available to patients in this setting. Hear from Chari on some of the available and anticipated regimens.
The latest data, the MMY-1001 study, which I presented at ASCO, is the Dara-Carfilzomib-Dex component of this study. So 1001 was a really great study design from Janssen. When Dara was first being studied, it's a phase one backbone, so basically taking Dara and partnering with every drug. And at the ASCO, we provided an update on DKD, or Dara-Carfilzomib-Dex. The schedule is Dara was given standard dose, although a substantial number got split dose of Dara, because in the community it can be hard to do a single infusion over 6 to 8 hours, which is the median time of first infusion. And so it was given in a split dose over 2 days, about 4 hours in each day. So that was shown to be quite effective, and actually the infusion-related reactions were actually lower in the split dosing. The carfilzomib was given 20 milligrams per meter squared day one and escalated to 70. So this is DKD. And what's kind of interesting about this is that, first of all, we don't know, the overall response rate was very high, 84%, but we don't even have a median PFS yet because it hasn't been reached. And what's particularly impressive and what we presented at ASCO is that even in lenalidomide refractory patients, the median PFS was 14 months. So that's very impressive given what we know about len refractory patients. And that is super important because in the US, most patients are getting triplet therapy, transplant, and then maintained on len, in which case, if you're len refractory, all of the great phase three studies that we have with the len backbone are not applicable to your patient because they wouldn't have been eligible. So it's nice to start accumulating data about len refractory patients, and that's what's really good about this DKD. And the efficacy was great, and we really saw no unusual safety signals. So it's a good option, and we hope it'll be approved soon so that we can give this more readily to our patients. So this year's ASCO meeting, Dr. Richardson presented the Optimism study, which is VD plus minus POM. And this is important because historically, POM was relegated to very advanced lines of therapy. The initial MM003 study was a median of 5 lines of therapy. Heavily treated patients, the response rate was only about 30%, PFS only about 4 months. And while those are good and, you know, it's a very important development for patients, that's not enough. And you really need higher response rate, higher PFS, and so you need to do combination therapy. But historically, POM was always being saved and relegated to the end of the line. And now, Optimism showed that when you move it up earlier, you get a significant improvement in PFS and response rate. So clearly, POM being used earlier is going to give you better numbers. And this just gives us another option of giving treatment for patients in relapse. And again, going back to the theme of len-refractory patients, which is really an issue in myeloma, a substantial number of patients in PVD were len refractory. So it's another active regimen that one can use. And so great to have choices.
Samir Parikh, MD, Associate Professor of Medicine within Mount Sinai Health System, concluded the meeting by focusing on two novel therapies with the potential to improve response rates among the relapse refractory population that Chari spoke to. Both selinexor and venetoclax are being tested in the salvage setting, he explained. In November 2018, the FDA granted a priority review designation to a new drug application for selinexor as a treatment for patients with penta-refractory myeloma. Though venetoclax has yet to receive any such designation, it showed an overall response rate of 67% in combination with bortezomib in a phase 1b study.
The two molecules, interestingly, are close to approval or already approved in other settings, and we have been using them successfully at Mount Sinai to treat and salvage patients with very resistant refractory multiple myeloma. The two drugs, the first drug I'll be talking about is an exportin inhibitor, oral molecule called selinexor. This drug has gone through both phase 1 and phase 2 trials and is currently excitingly in review at the FDA, and we anticipate that there will be a favorable review leading to approval next year. So the drug has a unique mechanism of action. It blocks a transporter called XPO1 or exportin-1, and this transporter is responsible for the shuttling of cargo proteins and messenger RNA between the nucleus and cytoplasm. And by blocking the export of these molecules, selinexor actually leads to certain key changes in the dynamic of tumor growth versus suppression that causes the cancer cell to die. So increase in tumor suppressor proteins like P53 and others, and reduction in oncogenic proteins such as MYC or the family of NF-kappa-B are very important for myeloma growth, and this shuts off the cells and causes them to die. Interestingly, the drug has been tested in a number of other cancers besides myeloma, and in all the cancers has a uniform overall response rate of about 20%. So clearly there is something unique about one-fifth of the human population that makes them sensitive to the drug. And my lab has been actually working on finding out what distinguishes the patients that respond and don't respond for long periods of time. And we have an early signal that's very promising and going to be presented at ASH. So what we did was we looked at patients that were treated with selinexor on some of these early trials and divided the patients into two groups. There were patients that had more than 3 months of response, or patients that had less than 3 months of response. And by taking the tumor cells, extracting the RNA and sequencing it, we were able to actually find differences between patients that responded with a PFS more than 3 months and patients that didn't. And interestingly, the key difference was a protein actually that's very important in cell cycle. So the change that we found was E2F1. This is going to be presented more in detail in a couple of months, but I'll give you the highlight today. The E2F1 protein seems to be very important in resistance to selinexor. So if patients have a high level of E2F1, then they are less likely to respond, and this could be an important biomarker for picking patients that will have better outcomes with this drug. We are finding that the drug is well tolerated in the majority of patients. We have to be mindful about certain side effects. Prominently, there are three classes of side effects that we look out for. The first is GI toxicity, so patients can have nausea, vomiting, anorexia, so we have to give the patient antiemetics and control them with hydration if needed, and most patients then tolerate the drug. The other big class of side effects is hematologic toxicity, so patients have
thrombocytopenia and frequently myelosuppression that can be dose limiting. So we have to monitor their counts closely. These are also very heavily refractory patients, so they have less marrow reserve. So we look at that, and we have been titrating the doses to tolerability, and these patients do well. The other interesting side effect is hyponatremia, so monitoring the chemistry profile is important, and we find that we can get these patients through the treatment and salvage them even with very refractory settings such as following CAR T failure. The other interesting aspect about this drug is that it works very well in combination with other approved drugs. It has been tested with carfilzomib and with Velcade. In fact, there are phase 3 trials currently going on testing bortezomib with or without selinexor in the post-transplant setting, and we look forward to the outcome of these studies as they roll out. So that's the first drug I'm talking about. The second drug I'm talking about is a molecule that's actually approved already in CLL. This is a drug called venetoclax. It has, again, a unique mechanism of action. It inhibits a pro-apoptotic protein called BCL2. And the way it does this is very interesting. It binds to a groove on BCL2 where proteins like BH3 mimetic proteins, BIM, bind to and displaces them and tells the cell to die by triggering a cascade of events where BIM then binds to BAX and then that forms pores in the mitochondrial membrane, leading to depolarization and ultimately cell death. So venetoclax has been so effective in certain other hematological malignancies that people have seen tumor lysis syndrome and in fact do a gradual ramp up. In myeloma, we have been using it off-label for a couple of years now, and there have been phase 1 studies and now phase 2 studies with venetoclax in combination with proteasome inhibitors that are showing remarkable efficacy. It turns out that patients that have a high BCL2 are particularly prone for responding to this drug. And at Sinai, we've actually built a genomic platform for interrogation of the patient's tumor cells by, again, doing RNA sequencing and estimating BCL2 levels in an effort to actually find patients that will be more sensitive to it, and then we prescribe the drug. I think that as more studies are going to be done, this is definitely going to be an important player in the management of myeloma. We do know currently that one of the mechanisms by which cells become resistant to venetoclax is through another pro-apoptotic protein called MCL1. And it turns out, very interestingly, that MCL1 in turn is degraded by a pro-apoptotic protein called NOXA, which is regulated by proteasome inhibitors. So we can increase artificially the level of NOXA by giving the patient bortezomib or carfilzomib, and therefore reduce MCL1, making the activity of venetoclax more potent. So this is something that we are actually using in Sinai, and we are again seeing refractory patients, even post-CAR T failure patients responding to this drug. So I'm very excited about the future of these molecules. These are definitely going to add to the armamentarium and open prospects for patients.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 26th episode of OncLive on Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to hear more about the treatment landscape of gastrointestinal malignancies, consider registering for the February 7th State of the Science Summit in Houston, Texas. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on GI cancers with the faculty of the Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center in Washington, D.C. on February 21st. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.